The future belongs to those who control the culture, and the culture belongs to those who control the conversation. So we are having the conversations you wish you could have at church to build a safe and vibrant community. This is the Oz Table Talk Podcast. So welcome to the Oz Table Talk Podcast. Today I am interviewing a very interesting Adventist. We're going to be talking to Caleb Isley this morning. Welcome to the show, Caleb.
Hey, thank you. Hi.
Hi. So obviously there's going to be a number of people out there listening who haven't come across your name before. So I was wondering if you could tell us perhaps who you are and what you're best known for.
Okay. Yeah. I think at this point, Humans of Adventism is generally what I'm best known for. I am the editor for a storytelling platform called Humans of Adventism. And what that means is that twice a week on Facebook, Instagram, and our website, I release stories from Seventh-day Adventists. And that sounds kind of generic, but I think what is actually going a little deeper into just the life and perspective of individual people who are Seventh-day Adventist. So it may not be your fundamental beliefs. It may not be a theological discussion. It might just be that someone works at a grocery store. It might be that, you know, someone lost their mom, or, you know, it might be that someone's dealing with racial injustice in their life. Really things that are important to Seventh-day Adventists. It's a broad topic, but it's a very, a human interest kind of page. And I've been doing this for about a year and a half. We have about 5,000 people that follow the page. And I would say that's generally what I'm known for. My work, I do most of the things for the page. I do have a small team of people who help me with keeping Instagram looking nice where I don't know how to do that. Or finding people to interview, things like that. But for the most part, you know, I am making the decisions with money. I am the person interviewing the people who share their stories, and the person deciding the general direction of the platform.
That is great. And one of the things that I really enjoy about Humans of Adventism as I read it is the fact that they are, it's not long and hard to read. You edit down into the most interesting parts of it, and so every time you read it, it's like you're getting this supercharged story in very short form, and I really enjoy that. It's very inspiring in a lot of ways.
Yeah, we do. I don't know if a lot of people realize that. You'll rarely see any words from me, even though this is taken from a conversation. You get that person's perspective only as much as possible. And you're right. We try to get to the very, very heart of what the story is and put that there, because people on social media aren't going to read pages and pages of things. So it's tailored to that experience.
Yeah. So we'll come back to Humans of Adventism, but just so people can gather some context for who Caleb is, let's just step back. And where did you grow up, for example?
Sure. When I was born, my parents lived in a trailer in Mississippi. Very, very poor. Actually, before I was born, that trailer didn't have running water or electricity. And by the time I came along, it did, but still very much, I mean, we were living on government assistance and just not in a good place financially. My mom, I think, was 20 or 21 when I was born. And my parents made the decision to move back to Indiana, where they had both gone to high school together, and try to find a better life and try to be around an education system that would help us out of that. So we moved back to Indiana. I think I was four And I went all through academy and everything, 12 years, in the same town in Indiana, Cicero, Indiana. So that's most of my growing up experience. I got married just a couple years after high school to my wife. And we've been living in South Carolina for 6 years now.
So how did you meet your wife?
It's funny. All of my family has met their partners in high school and at the same high school.
So you're keeping the tradition.
Yeah, there's actually a wall at Indiana Academy with all of the graduating classes from like 1914 on. Okay, and you can find my great-grandparents on that wall. You can find my grandparents on that wall. You can find my parents on that wall. And now my wife and I on the wall at Indiana Academy. And, you know, who knew? I mean, my wife's not even from Indiana. She's from Dominican Republic. And yet, at Indiana Academy, we met and just never broke up.
Wow. So was the quality that you saw in her that you said, I'm going to marry this woman?
I think I have always been a long-term planner, and I never understood dating as I saw it in my friends. I didn't understand trying people out, if that makes sense. I wanted to find someone that I trusted and that I enjoyed being around, that I felt safe with, and my wife was the first person to really reciprocate that kind of love and commitment. And just, I think the fact that we could be casual together, that we could be safe together, where we weren't pretending or trying too hard or anything, we were just felt content to be together. I think that's the number one quality. It wasn't exciting. It was exciting, but not in the, like, let's have fun, be energized kind of way. It was the exciting where this feels like home.
Yeah, this is the rest of my life, and I'm happy with that sort of excitement.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there were all kinds of obstacles, you know, in our way that it didn't matter. And, you know, to me, it never changed my mind. So because of that, that's kind of how I knew, like, okay, this is the person I would like to be with. I would like to keep feeling this way and keep living like this. And you know, I found that when we were, I think we were 15 and 16. but there was never a reason, you know, never anything in me that said, like, I'm not content with this. So I think that's just how it worked out for us.
And that's beautiful. You know, I mean, we live in a culture that says the exact opposite, right? The culture says, sure, try as many people out as possible. And, you know, eventually, you know, you'll find this magic right person. And then again, that normally seems to break down. And that just seems to be the culture that we live in. And yet you've gone totally countercultural to that and have had a beautiful experience, which is awesome to hear.
Yeah, and I'm very proud of my marriage. I love being married.
Yeah. So related to that, how do you feel? And I ask this from, I guess, my perspective as someone who has also been married. And I mean, I've been married for just over 5 years. And I know being married changed a lot of the way I looked at life and caused me to grow in many areas. So as you look back, how has being married changed you or impacted the way you relate to others?
I think being married forced me to be confident and decisive. In our particular situation, my wife had some issues with her legal status and citizenship, and it put us in a position where she was unable to work legally for a while. And so being, you know, we got married at 20 and 18, being in that position meant only one person can figure out how to pay our bills. We can figure it out together, but one person has to do the work. One person has to figure out how to meet these responsibilities at some level. And having someone that I cared about so much, I was a shy person. I did not enjoy taking control of situations. I did not enjoy interacting with people I didn't know, which is ironic now.
But yeah, considering what you do now.
and really, I got in these situations where it's like, you have no choice. Figure it out, or, you might not pay your bills. Your lights might go off, or you won't have a car to drive, or something like that. So over time, because I was in these situations where I was trying to make it work regardless, it was a lot of responsibility on someone, I think, for a young age. But at the same time, it turned me and developed me into a leader and someone who actually sought things first instead of reacting. So I learned very quickly, if you wait for crisis to react, it's much harder to deal with than if you are proactive with things and you find potential issues and you address them as soon as possible. So it actually sort of changed my personality.
That's a huge thing. It really is. As you just pointed out, I love what you so clearly articulated, that being proactive in life is really that should be the default standard. That is how the best life is lived. And the fact that you learned that so early is an amazing thing. A lot of people don't learn that till a lot later. When you and I were talking prior to prior to this interview, you mentioned that you mentioned that you've had a lot of responsibility for as long as you can remember. Was this the first stage of that, or did it go even earlier?
No. I would say that my life has always worked backwards, like a backwards funnel, where it starts out very, very difficult, and then it gets easier. And for me, the culture that I grew up in with my family, I told you that we were very poor when I was young. When I was six, my parents divorced, both remarried, and were still very poor in their new marriages. And so because my parents wanted me to go to school in Indiana and my mom moved to a different state, I stayed with my dad and my stepmom. And the way that they decided they were going to kind of climb the career ladder or decide what they wanted to do financially was they started a construction business. And both my dad and my stepmom are from families where work is the default. Like your every second is meant to be working. If you're not working, it's not productive. So there was no value on rest. There was no value on play. I mean, even as a child, I was working unless I was specifically given time. It might be a couple times a week where it's like, take a half an hour and go play a video game, or take a half an hour and go do this. But until I slept, from the time I woke, it was a regimented responsibility thing. And by the time I was even in high school, I was running our household and doing all of the domestic responsibilities for my family so that my parents could continue working on their business. So maybe I didn't cook often, but other than that, I cleaned, I maintained a lawn, I did all of the laundry and put it away, folded it neatly, managed a household at 15 years old. And so I have experience with the responsibility part. What I didn't have experience was being the person calling the shots. So growing up, I was told very specifically, you're going to do this now. You're going to do this now. This is the voice that just repeated for my entire growing up experience. It's time to do this. It's time to do this. But when I got out on my own, there was no voice, right? That there was the feeling that I need to be productive, but I had to be the one to decide, okay, it's time to do this. It's time to renew your license plate. It's time to file your taxes. It's time to, whatever the responsibility was.
Did you find that an easy transition or a hard or a difficult one? Was it like liberating, or was it a challenge to actually get yourself to the place where you realized that you were the one in the driver's seat?
Both. It was actually terrifying at first. The way that I moved out of my house immediately following high school graduation, and I didn't have anywhere to go, and so I moved in with my grandparents, and because I was coming from that culture, I had never lived with them or spent that much time, you know, staying with them, I would actually do weird things. Like, I would ask my grandma, you know, what I needed to do with the house, or I would ask her permission to leave, or just weird things like that, where I'd say, hey, can I go to the store? And she'd look at me like, you're 18 years old, you have a car, why are you asking
this? Yeah.
Yeah, like, why would I have an opinion on that? Just don't be out so late that I worry, you know, or something like that. And so it was very liberating, but it was from an extreme pressure to just emptiness. And I really struggled with figuring out how to handle that. And, you know, that same summer I was going for orientation at the college I was going to, and there was no one with me. No one to help me figure out how to do the paperwork, or what I should have brought, or where I would live, or how my bill would be handled, or anything like that. And so I was just completely lost. I was there, I was doing it. And I actually had a friend of mine from high school there at orientation, where his family kind of took me in and guided me through it. They're like, okay, you're by yourself. We'll help.
Praise God for people like that.
Yeah, and from there, I developed, you know, healthy mentorship relationships with people that I could ask these questions and things like that. But it was definitely a steep learning curve. So I was ready for the difficulty when I got married. But I don't know that I was used to. I definitely wasn't confident in that role. I definitely wasn't used to being the person who says something and that's what's happening.
So just before we get, I guess, too far away from your growing years, I know you've had firsthand experience with depression and suicidal thoughts. I was wondering if you could share some insight about that time in your life and maybe how you started to head in a positive direction through that.
Yeah, the worst time for me was actually before I got into my relationship with my wife. So maybe around the ages of 13 or 14. And because I was trapped in this environment that was so high pressure that it felt like this would be my life. Like, this is all I knew, and this is life. This is how it's lived. This is how everybody deals with it. I felt like if this is what life is, I can't do 80 years of this. You know, if I'm 13 or 14 and I am so weighed down and just feeling like I want to stay asleep instead of waking up the next day. You know, it was unimaginable to me that I could continue that for decades. And I also, my closest friends had taken some different classes where I didn't see them as much. So I was unable to talk about sort of the, you know, abusive situation I was in with anyone I trusted, because I didn't want to drive them away. And yet I couldn't find a way to be in a healthier place. I felt like I was forced into this, like there was nothing else. And I think one thing that really sealed my relationship with my wife is that she saw me during this. You know, the school year had started, we got to know each other a little bit, and she became someone that I trusted that I could talk about things like this. And she actually came into that with me. So she came to see where I lived and how I lived, and she interacted, and she actually came and worked with me. and involved herself in that life. And I thought, if anyone can put up with this, if anyone can see where I'm coming from and still want to be part of my life, I can't replicate that with anyone else ever again. You know, just knowing that background and seeing how it informs my actions now is important to me. You know, she's part of my history. So I think how I pulled out, I don't know that I pulled myself out. I think God really put someone in my life that I could trust, that didn't demand answers from me and didn't try to force a certain method, but was just there with me.
That's great. So I do want to change gears, and we're going to start like exploring your ministry. But before we do, I have one question. I was looking at something that you had to say online, and there was a very interesting quote within that I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah.
In it, you had spoken about some of the things in your life that you've seen, and the quote finished with these words: "Nobody asks about what you've seen. We ask about people's jobs and opinions, their kids and hobbies, but the scenes and memories haunting me say more about who I am than any of those things do."
Yes.
I assume a lot of that is wrapped up in the story that you've just given, but I guess I just wanted to ask you about that and see, are there any specific experiences that you consider to have shaped you more than any of the others?
I think it's more than just my childhood experience. I've taken work in all kinds of different areas since being married. And for the last couple of years, I've worked in low-income housing in South Carolina as a pest control technician. And so what that means is that every day I go inside someone's home that lives in the absolute poorest neighborhoods in the state. And so that means I'm around drugs. It means I'm around, you know, weapons and things like that, and people with all kinds of problems. And so more than just what I've seen as far as, you know, my childhood, it's what I've seen in other people's lives. And I have a real burden for people, I think, that's different because I've been exposed to their struggle and not just their problem. And what I mean by that is, when I encounter someone who has, say, a really bad drug problem, it's easy to flatten that. But when you get a look at their life and you see the situation that they're coming from, and that they may be using this to cope with something much darker than a drug problem, it gives you a totally different perspective. And so when I go about ministry, I'm thinking not just, you know, buzzwords and you know, topics that are common. I'm thinking of context. You know, I'm thinking, okay, so if this is the issue, what are all of the surrounding issues? Maybe this is just a symptom of a deeper problem.
And thus that makes the ministry much more powerful, because you're actually addressing causes, not symptoms.
Yeah, I feel like that I've been taught to look much, much deeper into human beings than we allow ourselves to often.
So in your experience, you've obviously seen a lot, you've been exposed to a lot. And so at some point, God started to reveal that he had bigger plans for you than where you were, bigger plans than pest control, so to speak. So how did that happen? How did you go from this, because we've been hearing your story and the experiences that you had, how did you go from there to being editor of Humans of Adventism?
Sure. When I started college, I did a secular version of this, sort of. I got very involved with the kind of music and arts scene in my town, participated in a lot of film work and things like that, and got to know people and started thinking about how I could help help them build, you know, themselves personally, but also their careers. So for several years, I actually ran a website that promoted people like this. But over time, I became much more interested in the human beings that I was working with than I was in their profit. And so I started trying to develop this, and I ran into a wall where a very small amount of people cared about that. They wanted it to interact with what I was doing in order to make more money or in order to get more fans or something like that, which makes sense business-wise. But my interest was in covering their lives. And so I started working on this, and toward the end, I started doing this picture and story kind of idea, but it wasn't fleshed out. Now, soon after that, I was brought back after 2 years of not going to church. I'd been Adventist the whole time. I had not been attending my church. And one of the things that my church sought my advice on was social media, because I was very active on there. And so I started thinking about, you know, how can I take this thing that I'm doing and apply it to Adventists? Because they don't seem to like the internet. You know, they...
That is such a great way of saying it. They don't seem to like
you know,
it.
They don't, if they are on the internet, it's informational and it's like the Great Controversy or potluck announcement or something like that. But it's not what I'm trying to do. And so I was like, well, I don't have the freedom to do something like that for the church. But I started mentioning it to people, and I was like, you know, this would be a really cool idea. You know, we have a lady at our church who her family built the church. You know, we have a guy in our church that's walking with a cane now, who's like 80, that used to be a semi-pro soccer player. And you would never know. But I just heard that at potluck, and I thought, that guy's got a story that never gets told to people who don't know him. You know, that's such an interesting thing that challenges how I view him. And so I started talking with my church, and thankfully my church has been behind me 100%. I mean, they're very supportive people. But my church membership did not want their faces online. So I was like, okay, so what do I do with that? You know, I don't know if I'm going to get sued if I use the name Adventist by the GC or somebody. You know, I don't know the rules. So I just sent out this email, like, to 30 people, prominent pastors that I had spoken with and people who worked for the Haystack at the time. I worked as a freelance writer for them once a month. And I just said, here's this idea. What do you think? If I make a page called Humans of Adventism, and I referenced Humans of New York, I showed like examples and things like that. And I said, if we did this for Adventists, how many people would follow this and support this? And I think three people emailed me back, three or four. And Roger Hernandez, actually, I don't know if the pastor here, he sent me this very simple thing that said, I like it, do it. And that was just very encouraging to me. It wasn't complicated. It was like, go for it, man. Like, just do something. And I had one friend that stuck with me from the very beginning and just did everything he could to support it. But those people don't know that they could have made or broken this existing. Just that feedback that I had, some people who are like, this is valuable, in my mind, helped me make the decision to just go ahead and do it. And so, you know, I started with people I knew, started doing friends of their friends and things like that, and interviewing them. And eventually, once I got some audience, then I could just say to any random Adventist, hey, I'm Caleb with Humans of Adventism. you know?
Yeah. You had credibility at that point, so.
Yeah. And real credibility for us hasn't really been there until mid-year this year, when the NAD and several more prominent people started saying, hey, we recognize this ministry. But it took a long time.
Just take a pause there for a second. So you, based on what you've said so far, you know, you have felt a great need for permission, right? To do things and action things. And so even though you largely have overcome that at this point, what did it feel like for you when you see someone at an NAD level, at a division level saying, yeah, you know, we recognize Humans of Adventism as a ministry. What was that like for you?
Shocking. Absolutely shocking, because one of my real issues personally with being connected to the church is I want to see it succeed. I have a particular skill set that they don't seem to want. Right? I want to use this for the church. They don't seem to want me to. And so hearing that they do, and hearing that they're willing to support me even though I am not sponsored by the NAD, was a huge deal to me. And just, I think personally gave me a lot of hope for my relationship with corporate Adventism.
Why do you think corporate Adventism is, or has been, I don't know if slow is the right word, but very much reluctant to enter into the area of ministry that you're in? Why do you think that it's such a new ground that's being broken?
I think we don't have enough diversity in leadership, especially age diversity. Mm-hmm. I think that anyone in any leadership position is going to go with what they know and try to make what they know work. If you think about in the future, 30, 40 years from now, say that we are running the church, are we going to be open to a 23-year-old person coming in and saying, how you're doing things is not working? We need a new way, and I have the answer. When we've been doing this, say we're still doing podcasts, say we're still doing Humans of Adventism, and someone tells us what you're doing isn't working. You know, I see the struggle there.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, or fortunately, for all of us, recognizing something in someone that you may not have personally is very important to the growth of the church. You know, I think we're all going to have to face this at some point. And I think diversifying leadership would help that naturally, because you would have people who would be like, okay, I see it. You know, I think this way. I can relate. Now let me help my team understand.
So if, hypothetically, if someone gave you, you know, some conference somewhere or union or whatever gives you the keys to their media/communications department and says you have complete authority, what would it look like? What would you do?
Yeah, I've been in discussions like this. I don't know that anyone will ever hand me the key without leaving their hand on the key. However, I do think that even if they are not quite as uncensored or quite as open to the topics we cover, there's value in this format. There's value in exploring these kinds of stories. And I think on the conference level, I mean, even on the local church level, I'm going around talking about how to create a Facebook page at your local church and things like that. Okay. And one of the most common questions is, well, what do we put on there? You know, what do we put on there? Because people want to copy something from somewhere and paste it instead of creating content. But your church is full of people who are full of stories. And if you can get them to trust you enough to share those stories, I could see every church. You know, I would personally love, if I'm going to a new town, and I would love to not drive by that Adventist church and think, better not. I don't know what I'm going to find in there. Right? I would like to be able to see, these are the people who go here. These are their stories. These are some things that you can talk to them about. If you know that the person in that church is the same person on that Facebook page that you saw, you know, that was talking about, hey, I've really been struggling with this thing, and you struggle with it too. When you see that person and you walk in, you say, hey, I saw you on Facebook. You know, I read your story. We actually had someone in our conference, in the Carolina conference, who moved in from out of state. They got a job for the conference. And when they got to the office there, they'd never met anyone there. But when they walked in, they said, hey, I saw your story on Humans of Adventism, to another person. Immediately, they have some way to connect.
You've built a bridge. Right?
Yeah. And I didn't know either of these people. You know, it's just, it gives us a way of initiating relationships. And if there's one thing that we need between Adventists and people who are not Adventist, is this initiating of relationships.
And that actually, that leads into something that I wanted to talk about. So we do have a tendency, I think it's a human tendency, but as a church particularly, we have this natural tendency to build walls rather than bridges. And I just wondered, in your perception, why is that the natural stance rather than the opposite?
Part of it, I think, is that in Adventism, we've relied on a theology of fear in some areas. And so it's created this culture of people wanting to defend their faith, defend themselves, defend Jesus, right? But Jesus doesn't need us to defend him. I mean, if you look at, even in the Old Testament, he's saying, look, I've got this. You just do your part. You know, I don't need a human to stand up for me. I'm standing up for you. But I think as a whole, self-defense is and self-preservation is definitely our natural tendency. And that's kind of part of the point of Christianity, is running counter to that. It's self-sacrifice. You know, it's giving of yourself. It's loving your enemy. And it's ironic to see that, because when you have a sermon about Jesus and the culture is all walls, it kills the message. It makes it nullifies it.
And so at least at a local church level, and I'm focusing on local church simply because that's where most of the people that would be listening to this podcast actually have influence. So what would be at a local church level, what would be an effective way of building those bridges instead? I mean, you've mentioned one, which I think is brilliant. And to be perfectly honest, I'm thinking of ways I can do that at my church now. Yeah. How do I tell the people stories? So that's one really clear way. But are there any other ways that you've either tried or would like to try or have seen done to effectively build those bridges?
Yeah. We could talk about either building between people in the church already, or between your church and the community.
Okay. So
which of those are you thinking?
So I was thinking with the community, but I guess it's also worth mentioning that both are necessary, right?
Yeah. I think with the community, I have a real heart for this one. Taking the church to them is kind of the model that I'm trying to work toward. Instead of trying to lure people to us, going and taking as much of the church and as much of Jesus' character to them as possible. And how you do that is you, first of all, have conversations with people who aren't Adventist. I've been in several conversations recently where people are saying, well, you know, how do I do that? You know, I can't just walk outside and be like, are you anybody not Adventist out here? You know? So you intentionally alter your life to put yourself in areas where people aren't Adventist. One way I do this, I pick a local business and I frequent it, even if I don't need to, right? Even if I maybe I'm spending $10 a week or something that I wouldn't otherwise, that I don't need to. But I'm going there, I'm getting to know the people there, I'm understanding the culture of that business and the people who are there, their regulars, things like that, and I'm sharing a piece of my life with them. And so I ask. I mean, I go in, I say, how are things? I know you just opened up. What challenges are you facing? And you find out all kinds of things. They didn't know that their rent was going to be as high as it is, or their power went out on a big sales day, or who knows. But you build this relationship with them, and then the hard part to convince us of is never become a salesman. Okay. As soon as someone finds out that you are there to try to convert them, or you are there to talk them into coming to church, it has the opposite effect. You ruin your relationship. The way that you, I think, could go about it is to be openly Adventist, to be honest. Don't hide where you go to church. Don't hide what you're doing if you're going to prayer meeting that night. Talk about it. Just it can come up naturally in conversation if they're wanting to know more about you. But it's the fact that you are there, you are a Christ-like person, and you are interested in supporting them, that is the witness. It's not the sales pitch.
That's actually really amazing that you use that as an example, because one of the things that I do even for my work is that I coach people who are freelance in the web design and marketing fields. And one of the very things, I had this conversation with a guy that I'm working with yesterday, and I said the very last thing that you want to do if you're going to have an effective relationship with a potential client, the very last thing you want to do is start by selling to them. You need to find a legitimate way you can be in their life in a way that you're serving them with
Yes.
nothing to be coming back to you. And that provides a context in which you can have a sales conversation, but you are never leading with the sales conversation. You're never instigating that. You start with the service. And the interesting thing is, that's just the way humans operate, and it should be the way we operate with the gospel. I love what you're saying.
Absolutely. And you can see the effects of this playing out in my town. Maybe 6 months ago, Humans of Adventism was on the front page of our newspaper.
Yeah, I saw
Okay.
that on social media. Yeah, that's awesome.
And people are like, "Well, how'd you do that?" They're thinking that I sent them an email that says, "Put Humans of Adventism on the newspaper," and that worked. No. I've been supporting my local newspaper for a long time. I've been sharing their articles. I've been messaging and sending encouragement to the staff. This was a really good story. Thank you for covering that. I learned a lot. I've been maintaining a relationship when I didn't need something. And then when something came up, I say, "Hey, we just had this awesome thing happen. We made magazines. We have 25 Adventist stories in it. This would be a great thing, to tell people about in Orangeburg. Whether you want to put it in the newspaper or not, I want to send you guys some copies of this." So the staff took it, they read it, and they said, "Yeah, this is awesome. We don't have a lot of young people doing innovative things in this area. So let's do it." And I mean, on the cover it says Seventh-day Adventist seeks to build bridge between church and community, or something like that. And they printed the material, they sent it everywhere. I mean, it's if I had just taken it to their office and said, "Hey, I want you to print this," it never would have worked.
Yeah, they would have said, "Oh, it's somebody else trying to advertise, right?"
Exactly.
Yeah. So I just find this way of thinking is very rare, and I guess I'm wondering, where did that come from for you? Is that just something innate that is just a part of your personality, or was it learned? Did you see it modeled?
I think this is one good thing, very positive thing that I took from both of my parents, and that is they look for people to help. My dad knew people everywhere, and he had worked for a lot of people, but he also was always the person stopping if there was someone broken down on the side of the road. He was always the person if he heard somebody didn't have transportation, he was giving them rides. He was always the person who I remember a guy who worked for him lost his house, and the guy moved in with us for a little while. Like he stayed with us because he didn't have somewhere to stay. And my mom and my stepdad as well, they have found people and quietly supported them. And when they didn't have somebody who needed something, they found someone who needed something. You know, it was an intentional, regular part of their life. So I think I learned from watching them, really.
And that's great. Are there any other, just while we're on that topic, are there any other mentors, and that could take the form of like literal people that you know in person, or even if large influences come from authors or preachers, who would you consider to be your biggest influences?
Man, I have a lot. I feel like I sort of have an online village raising me now. I would say that my local pastor is a huge influence in my life because of this just accepting me not based on my attendance but on who I am as a person. I would also say in the past year, I don't know if I'd call it a mentorship, but Justin Koo and I have formed a real close friendship, that Christian blogger, where, I mean, several times a week we are able to say, hey, this is this idea I just came up with where we can, you know, do this and interact with people in this way, or we can create this. And it's just this constant flow of ideas and feedback and things. So I would say, you know, I'm learning a lot from him. And then I would also say Dr. Heather Thompson Day at Andrews has been a huge influence on me, not just in watching her work, but also in being the type of person who, if she sees that I am struggling with a decision or a hard time in life, she's a person who will message me and say, hey, can I pray for you really quick? Or is there anything that we can do to support you right now? Or, you know, that personal, even if it's just listening, reaching out. And I've never met her in person. You know, some of my mentors, they're people I've started developing relationships with online.
And that's the beauty of having, like you were saying before, the online village, right?
Yeah.
So I know for me, like even I live in a regional city, and there would be an incredibly small pool of people if not for the internet that I can relate to and connect with. And so that's very valuable. It's good to point that out.
Absolutely.
So just to look to the future a little bit, where do you feel that Humans of Adventism is going? You have come so far in a comparatively short space of time. So what's next?
I think that I would measure success by seeing this enacted in other places, not necessarily controlled by me. I would really like to see churches use this. But as for my personal plans, I've had the idea run by me several times of developing area-based Humans of Adventism pages, kind of an umbrella type of thing where Humans of Adventism is over several smaller, or maybe not even smaller, maybe it would get bigger than us, but other pages that were focused on the area. It's going to be difficult to develop that and figure out just how they would be funded and what the different permissions would be for the people doing it, you know, that kind of thing. But I think I've always been pretty clear in that I want to take this wherever people are, and part of that is offline. And so developing more print material, podcasts, things like that, those are all potentially in the plans. We will probably take one direction and grow that at a time just to make sure that it's done well. But what direction that goes with in the coming year depends more on the people that we're collaborating with and their availability and interest in the direction we want to go. I will say that we will be remaining independent of corporate sponsorship.
Yeah, and that's a big decision to make. Is that simply because you want to maintain the independent nature of it, or are there any other reasons?
The number one reason is that the content that I believe would be censored by corporate sponsorship is very, very vital to the health of the page. If we had Humans of Adventism with no ability to cover LGBTQ Adventist stories, for me, that matters. Because if someone's Adventist and this is their life and this is part of their story, it's a very important part of their story. No matter where you stand on it, this is affecting every aspect of this person's life.
And so if you're going to be telling the whole story, you need to be free to tell the whole story.
And the stories that we're uncomfortable with as a church sometimes are the ones we need to hear the most.
Yeah, that's a
And
really powerful statement.
that's the big reason. I would love to have dependable income coming in from it. I think that if there is an opportunity to do this full time, I'd love to explore that, but not at the expense of its value.
Yeah, that's that absolutely, and I know you, with what you do, it would be amazing. I'd love to see what you could do with it if you were full time in it. So I hope that you can achieve that at some point.
What we've seen so far has been what I've been able to do on my cell phone, working 60 hours a week at a manual labor job. So if I get the opportunity to have more time and really dedicate my mental energy to this, I would love to see that too. My heart is in this.
Yeah. So just one of the things that I would like to offer is if anybody is out there listening and they're saying, "Wow, I really love what Caleb's doing. I would love to help in some way." Caleb, what would be the best way for them to do that? Where can they find you, and how can they help if they feel like they would love to?
Sure. If someone is blessed financially and wants to help us, the most helpful thing you can do is find us on Patreon. It's just patreon.com/AdventistHumans, and for it's a monthly thing where you can sign up for anywhere from $5 a month to whatever you can afford. That allows us to be crowd and audience funded. And that's important for us because no one person can decide what Humans of Adventism does. But not everybody has money that they can afford every month, or some people are supporting multiple ministries. I support, I think, four or five different people on Patreon. So there's a limit, I understand. What you can do for free is interact with us on social media. Sharing our stories is incredibly valuable. And even just maybe sharing, some encouragement or some interaction with the story, if you have a particular take on it, join the conversation. I think there's a lot of value in social currency as well. And that's something we all have.
Yeah, definitely. And just to put an exclamation mark after that point, if everybody that's out there interacts with the stories or shares them, that is worth more than money in some cases. Because if you can share it out and another 1,000 people see it, that's better than advertising money in a lot of cases. Absolutely. So
I think I didn't fully answer your question. And I always do this in every interview. There's a question that I didn't answer. Hopefully I'll be better this time. Mm-hmm. Facebook.com/humansofadventism mm-hmm. is where you'll find us on Facebook. Instagram @humansofadventism. Or if you'd like to check out our website, we have all of the podcast interviews we've done, all the videos we've done, all the stories we've done, AdventistHumans.com.
That's great. Well, Caleb, I want to thank you so much for your time being on the show with us. It's been a great time together.
Yeah, thank you for having me again.
Mm-hmm. No worries. Well, everyone, I will leave it there. If you've enjoyed this interview, please tell us about it in the comments, share it with your friends, and we look forward to seeing you guys next week for our next episode. And that's the end of another episode. Just before I head off, I want to encourage you to go over to our page on Facebook and also our account on Instagram and follow us there, because that is where we interact with our listeners, and we would love for you to enter in and join the conversation. Also, while you're signing up, I would also recommend signing up to our mailing list on our website, oztabletalk.com.au. If you do that, you will receive our exclusive content, because occasionally we do release exclusives and they only go out to our mailing list. So I would strongly recommend you go and sign up for that. If you have a few more minutes to be one of the most amazing listeners on the planet, you can go over to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review, because reviews help us to grow and they help other people to find us. So if you want to help us reach those goals, please jump in and give us a review. The final message that I'd like to leave you with is to let you know about our Patreon account. Now, Patreon is a way for creators to get paid for creating, and ultimately what we do does cost money to get us hosted and have the services that we need to run the podcast. And so if you'd like to help us do that, jump over onto patreon.com/oztabletalk, and you can give anything from even $1 a month upwards. But at different levels, there are different benefits, different rewards that we want to give you just to say thank you for being an amazing supporter of ours. If you can't afford that, we would just gratefully accept your prayers, because that is what our ministry runs on. And so with that, I will leave you to your day, and thank you so much for listening to this episode. We look forward to seeing you guys next week.